This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're in the studios, and I'm Grace Cavalieri. Haley Lighthouser's here. I have waited to see her since 2013, when Swoop came out. I've always wanted to meet her in person, and today I did. So read us an opening poem.
Okay. This poem was really inspired by the whole book was inspired by my brother, who does not read poetry. No one in my family had the slightest interest in poetry. But one day he sent me a palindrome. I believe the one he sent me was Red Rum, Sir, is Murder. And he said, this sounds like something in one of your poems.
You have to tell everyone what a palindrome is.
Oh, a palindrome is a sentence or a phrase that the letters read the same backwards as forwards.
Like madam.
Yes, like madam. Madam, I'm Adam. That's a palindrome. Anyway, he sent me Red Rum, Sir, is Murder. And I thought, that's right. That really does sound like something I would say. And I said, how wonderful palindromes would be to use because they have music inside them, you know, built into them. So I started working with palindromes.
Oh.
And I got a bunch off the net and I invented a bunch of myself. And one thing was a lot of my palindromes had O in them. And I had written a palindrome I really liked, O Nat Tango. And so I'm playing around with them. And then one day I read a writer, and I can't remember who it was, but he said, a poet is only allowed to use the word O three times in their entire career. And I'm like, I'm using O three times in a single poem. And I've got all these wonderful palindromes with O in them. And so what am I going to do? So I finally said, hung for a lamb, hung for a sheep. And I wrote this poem, O, She Says.
Let's hear it.
O, she says, because she loves to say O. O to this cloud break that ravels the night. O to this moon, its mouthful of sorrow. O shallow grass and the nettle burr's bite. O to heart's flare, its wobbly satellite. O step after step in stumbling tempo. O owl and oak, O rout of black bat flight. O moaned in attic and Esperanto. O covetous tongue, O fat fandango. O Nat Tango in the hot ochred light. O windward leaves in subtle inferno, O flexing of sea, O stars bolted tight, O ludicrous swoon, O blind hindsight, O torching of bridges and blood boiled white, O sparrow and arrow and hell below. O, she says, because she loves to say O.
Haley Lighthouser, I read you 10 years ago, and I said, why can't I do that? Why can't I do that? And ever since I've read you, I've said, how does she get helium in language? And people say, she puts such energy unleashed on the line. When they say that, what do you think they're meaning? What do you think they mean?
Well, the kind of the theme, if there is one theme to this book, Swoop, is excess.
But what do you think they mean when they say you're energy is like John Ashbery's. It's like unvaulted. Mm. It's like nothing we've ever seen on the line before. Has anyone said that? They say it to me.
I've had comments on my energy. I don't think I'm the only one doing it, or certainly not the only one who ever has done it. But
do you know you do it?
I know I do it in some poems. Some poems I try to be a bit more subtle, but I'm using very exuberant language. I'm using language that's almost comic in exuberance. And to do that, then you have to just go with that. You have to go over the top or it's not going to work.
There you go. You use excessive, exuberant language. That is a great answer. Let's have two more in a row.
Okay, I'm going to pick, I'm going to read one that you said that you liked. This is from a series of poems that I modeled after Hopkins' Kirtle sonnets. And each of them has sex in the title. There's sex al fresco and sex Rubenesque. And this one is sex obstreperous. And the palindrome is in the very first line. Sex obstreperous. Oh, Naomi, did I moan a moan too odious? Did I rasp a ruined gasp too proud? Was my sweetest lying unenticing and my crooning just palaver chattered to a drone? My pillow talk an awkward spout, my coos a black crow crying. Did I couch a murmur overriding an untune, growl an innuendo too aroused? Were my sighings those of mufflers dying? Did I snore like a platoon? Did I pout or crowd or groan? Oh dear, revered Naomi, was I loud?
I just can't tell you what I think about your work. It's like no one else's. So you have all of these addresses, approaches to sex, and each one is funnier than the last. But that was a great example. Let's hear another poem.
This was a poem that Garrison Keillor read on the Writer's Almanac. And I was very surprised that he chose it because to me it is an exuberant poem. And he read it in his usual sort of deadpan manner. And I thought it was very interesting. And I hear his voice sometimes when I'm reading it. It's a rondeau, and it's called The Old Woman Gets Drunk with the Moon.
And explain what a rondeau is.
A rondeau is a form. You have a repeating A and B line. It has, let me see, 5 lines in the first stanza, 4 in the next, and 6 in the last. And the traditional rondeau cuts the first sentence. In this case, that's the moon is rising everywhere. And the abbreviated sentence is used as the ending to the last two. I do a variant on it. When I get to the final stanza, I go back to the entire full-length first sentence.
Let's hear it.
The old woman gets drunk with the moon. The moon is rising everywhere. The moon's my favorite easy chair, my tin pot top, my green plum tree, my brassy button cavalry tap dancing up a crystal stair. Oh, watch them pitch and take the air like shoofly pies and signal flares, like clotted cream and bumblebees, the moon's arising. How hits the spot, how debonair, what swooned balloons of savoir faire. What purr of rain-blurred bright marquees that linger late, that wait for me, who'll someday rest my cold bones there in moons that rise up everywhere.
Honey, your O's have got me. You had me at your O's. I'm telling you, your double O's. That is absolutely magnificent.
Well, thank you.
So you're a formalist.
Sometimes.
A funny form, a comic, wonderful formalist, mm-hmm. and an unusual one, too, because what you do within the form is very playful, and it is satirical, and it is just having lots of fun. So here you are writing these poems, writing Swoop. Was that your first book?
Yes.
Okay.
Or it's the first one published.
And so you're writing as if you can't, no one is watching you. You write as if there's nothing to lose, nothing at stake. Mm-hmm. But here's the funny thing. Everyone gets it. And that was the surprise for me, that all of these prizes you've won and all these editors and publishers, they get you. Did you know that would happen?
I was surprised. When I read the first few reviews of Swoop, they knew things about me that I didn't realize about myself. I thought that the poems were all just happy silliness. But then I know you look have a shocked look on your face. And someone wrote and said that I used humor as a defense against despair. And I was shocked when I read that. And I said, no. But then I went back and looked at them and said, yeah, well, maybe a little bit. And I didn't realize that there was a darkness in them that I had been unaware of.
I don't call it dark, but it is deep. These things are not superficial, as humorous as they are. They have layers that... What you do with language. So do you start with a sound and then go on to see if it triggers another sound, and then that sound triggers a word, and then that word makes meaning?
Usually it's, with Swoop, a lot of these poems came from the palindromes. I had a list of about 200 palindromes, and I would say I had the palindrome, Naomi, did I moan? And I was
Where
writing,
did you find them?
I found some of them online, and some of them I wrote myself. I wrote O Nat Tango myself. The beginning of a poem, Sex Al Fresco, is Never One Volt Love Nor Even. That one I wrote myself.
Where's the palindrome?
That whole sentence is a palindrome. Never one volt love nor even.
So if we look at it backwards, it will be the same as frontwards.
It reads the same backwards.
Did you start with it backwards or frontwards?
Well, you start with it frontwards.
But how do you know it's going to work?
Oh, you don't. You just play. And it gets to be certain tricks that you get used to using, yeah. You know, like a lot of words both start with R-E and end in E-R, and even oh. and seven. There's a lot
Why
of tricks.
Why don't you write an essay about this?
Oh, I hate writing essays.
Okay, okay.
I just had to do one. I just had to write an essay on a poem by Kay Ryan, who I adore. But the essay, the very short essay, took me 6 weeks and just about killed me.
I cannot wait to read it.
Well, it will be in a new magazine, Revel, which is coming out in the fall.
Rebel or Revel?
Revel, R-E-V-E-L.
I've heard of that
already.
And
it is edited by Atsur O'Reilly, and it looks to be a very exciting magazine, and I'm very excited to be a part of it.
And you're doing the essay and the one poem. And mm-hmm. did you choose the poem?
I sent him, I think, six poems, and he chose one.
And
yes, it was a triolet.
And tell everyone what a triolet is.
A triolet is a form, a very short form, a very strict form, and it's eight lines in which one line is repeated three times and one line is repeated twice. So it's basically only five fresh lines. And it's a form I've absolutely fallen in love with.
Absolutely. It's really good for beginner poets. They can do it.
The first one took me a year to write.
But you're a Haley Lighthouser. I mean, you are. We expect this from you. This is what you do. What else should you be doing?
Well, I didn't expect it starting out. But once I got that first one, I've been writing triolets ever since, and that's absolutely my favorite form now.
Well, give me two more poems.
Okay. I'm going to read a couple from Saint Worm.
And tell us why it's called Saint Worm.
Okay. I had a manuscript that wasn't working. It wasn't going together. And one day I was reading the poem Fresh Air. And there's a line in Fresh Air in which he says, "What worms they are." And it has absolutely nothing to do with actual worms. He's talking about writers. But as soon as he said it, I said, "Worms, that's the perfect topic for me." Because I love to write about things that people sometimes call disgusting, or what I call praise of the lowly. And then worms would give me excuse to write short little wiggly lines with a lot of rhyme in them. And so I started writing a series. I think there are eight worm poems in this book. And while I was doing it, I said, well, if I'm going to write about worms, I absolutely have to have a poem called Bookworm. And I just went online and did a little research. And a lot of the poems in this book have to do with mortality. And when I read about the bookworm, I found the only kind that literally ate books was a larva of something called the Death Watch beetle. And so as soon as I saw that, it's like, okay, that's my poem. So this is called Bookworm. This is the stuff, the bright purple juice a pawn of the grape could blither and faint for, swilling and swallowing vowel and consonant, macron, haycheck, oganek, and umlaut, confounding the mouth with curlicue, dot, straight, Roman numeral, serif, and loop. This is the gist, salty and salty and sweet, the chewing, the sate, garamond, blackadder, pristina, script. Here is the clambake, potlatch, a shinny, a picnic, a barbecue blowout, stick a fork in it slowly, so slowly, let each perfect word steep brown in its paper. Let paper be pulp, let pulp be pastiche, let grist greet the gullet bowel blessed solemnly. There is room for us, place, there is space for the ages. We're all scribbled on water. Bring out the dead.
See, when you go from paper to pulp to pastiche, that's where I think you're led by sound.
Mm-hmm.
And you are, you know, Jury Graham was here, and I think she's a genius. And I think I've met another genius today.
Oh, well.
Haley, nobody does what you do. It's not right. It's not right.
It's not right more than I'll go with I'm a genius.
It's so wrong, it's right. I mean, this is from another galaxy, what you're doing. And yet everyone gets it. It's like, oh, they understand every word you're saying. So let's hear another poem.
Okay.
I just have to say, you're a combination of John Donne, Shakespeare, Nora Ephron, and Elaine May.
Oh, I like the Elaine May. I would love to have any of her DNA in my system. Okay, I will read. This is a poem about growing old. This was inspired when a friend of mine stepped off a curb and broke her ankle. You get to our age, and any little fall can be a big problem.
But you're so immature, it will never happen.
Yes, I'm so immature. Anyway, it's called Message. Beware it, friend. Beware it now. Beware it then. Beware its steps upon the stair. Beware what jiggles handles at your door, what twists the rugs of hallway floors. Beware boudoirs, their soft-ticked dark. Be scared of all that treads outdoors. Take guard, take time, take caution as you cautious climb. Approach with dread what you once dared. Take sense in all that stirs in air. Take in each tiny step great care. Let autumn come, let summer go. Let spring shake off its weight of snow. Be bare once more, no fear, old friend. Be wary as you go again.
Cautionary tale.
Yes.
But do you feel as if you're, as you get seasoned, that your poetry's changing?
Yes, yes, I definitely think it's changing.
And you think your second book is different from your first book, how?
Boy, that's a hard question.
Because there's, what, 5 years between them?
Really, this book was mostly written by the time Swoop came out. There are a lot of earlier poems that predate Swoop that are in this.
That's just publishing.
Yes. I was publishing in magazines for, God, 10, 15 years
before. Well, I've known your name for a long time.
I got very lucky with magazines very early. Mm-hmm. And so I've never had trouble getting poems in magazines.
But you do not do that so much anymore.
Well, I really kind of shut down during COVID. I wasn't writing much at all. But I had a burst this year, and I have maybe 6 publications coming out this fall and winter. So
what are they?
Let me see. I just had a couple poems in. All right, let me get this right. Literary Matters, just did a few. And I was approached by Wendy Vidluck, who's a poet I just adore. And she was editing an anthology on mushrooms. And so I wrote a couple mushroom poems, and those are in Literary Matters. And one of them will be in her book coming out. I have 3 poems coming out in 32 Poems, which is one of my favorite magazines. I just had a poem in Agni called Tiptoe Ode.
You know, Agni is so time-honored. I don't even think you know this.
Oh, I know. It's a wonderful magazine.
Oh, my God. I had a poem in there in 1968, and it was a stapled chapstick.
My goodness.
It was stapled. I have it in the library, the GW Library now, in the special collections. And it was just like a little teeny staple thing. And it's gone, how many years could this be?
I don't know.
40 or 50.
It's absolutely one of my favorite magazines.
It's very classic.
They were one of the first magazines to pick me up.
They understand you.
They've been a real help to me. And sometimes I pick up the magazine and I'm very intimidated by the other poems in there.
Have you been in more than once?
Oh, I've been in steadily since I first started publishing. Yes. I'm usually in every year and a half. I'm saying that and I need to check my records and see.
So I'm surprised. I did not know that you were putting out to the market that way. I just didn't know. I was unaware. Now I'll be more awake about that.
Uh-huh.
More, please.
Oh, okay.
This is from St. Worm. But you know, I have to take a station break and tell everyone who you are. And she is the author of Swoop, as we said. And she won the Poetry Foundation's Emily Dickinson First Book Prize, the Towson Award for Literature, and a finalist for the Kate Duff's Discovery Award. And then St. Worm is her second book, and that was published by Able Muse Press. And her work, as we're talking about, has been universally published in journals and magazines. And I can remember a few that I've read. And 3 times in the Best American Poetry. David Layman chose those?
Let me see. My editors were Amy Gertzler.
Yes.
Sherman Alexi and Darren Hayes.
They were the guest editors.
Yeah, they were the guest editors. They picked
for
them.
For David Layman's magazine. Let's hear this.
Okay, this is a villanelle.
Which is?
It is a form of 6 stanzas. There's repeat, the first and third lines of the first stanza repeat as the end lines throughout the poem, and then at the final 4-line stanza, the first and third lines of the first stanza are the last 2 lines. That's not too complicated.
And you did it without even looking down. Let's hear it.
I've written a few of these. Okay. In my last past life. In my last past life, I had a nut brown wife. A gray and white house looking over the sea. A forest for love and a river for grief. A goshawk for beauty, for courage and knife. A city for distance, lights spread on the sea. In my last past life, I had a brown wife. Subtle and busy and contented and brief, she stood in the dusk, silhouette with the sea. A forest and love and a river, and grief was a ghost hidden green in the leaves, an echo off cliffs that bound back the sea. In my life it would last, my past and my wife, the wrens in the garden, the moon on the roof, day winds that flirted and teased at the sea. The forest that loved and the river that grieved, the life that was garden and day wind and thief, each sunrise and sundown, the turn of the sea. The life that I had in my last brown wife, a forest for love, a still river for grief.
One thing that you can do, you do so many different things. You can write folkloric poetry, almost like fairy tales. And there, I'm reading some ancient Chinese poetry right now, like we're talking 400 and 700, and it has the same tone as yours. A land where mushrooms grow on the roof, you know, a never-never land where you live in your imagination and make it come so much to life, standing in the sea, and a brown, nut brown wife.
That started, I had the first line, in my last past life, I had a nut brown wife. I had it for years trying to do something, and it kept coming out as a very light fairy tale type poem, and it just wasn't working. And it didn't take that elegiac tone on until that's when it finally began to work.
But did a villanelle help?
Yes.
Yeah.
And what also helped was, I don't know if you noticed, but you know the middle line of each stanza is supposed to rhyme.
Oh,
I just
did.
Repeated the word sea in each one of those, because the sea became a great metaphor for this whole idea of the loss and the life and the repetition
and
the
eternity.
Change. Yes, an eternity. And so that, as soon as I was using sea in each stanza, then it found its voice.
That is the metaphor for the poem. A lot is going on in that. But I do believe that the villanelle carried you out along.
Yes.
Where you might not have gone otherwise, in a narrative or a blank verse.
Well, my little saying that I give to students when I do workshops, which I'm certainly not the first person to say it, but I say, form is your best servant and your worst master.
Very well said.
And you just have to, and if sometimes the form makes the poem happen, and if instead you are serving the form at the expense of the poem, then you have to throw the form out and go to free verse.
But with you, you don't even know what the form is. Because it flows. I mean, if you don't tell us a villanelle, all we hear is repetition, like the waves coming back from the water over and over again. And we get lost in that. And we don't say, this is a villanelle, which is our goal.
Yes.
It's our goal.
That's when I'm reading a formalist poem and I don't realize it's a formalist poem until the end. I remember reading a Sestina by Seamus Heaney. I got all the way through the Sestina before I realized it was. And that's a hard trick to do.
You do it. You do it. Uh-huh. Yeah. So I hope you have more.
Yes. This is from a new manuscript I'm working on. This poem is about Florida. Now, I spent the first half of my childhood in Florida. And I've never been able to write about it. And it makes me crazy that there are all these poets from Boston and Denver and Portland, Oregon, who move down to Florida, teach or retire or whatever, and they write beautiful poems about Florida. Well, I couldn't do it. And so I just sat down one day and said, I'm going to write about Florida. If it kills
me. Did you like Florida?
Yes and no. It's a great place to visit. I wouldn't want to live there.
How long did you live there?
I left when I was 10. So it was only the first. But my family still had roots there. My father kept a condo.
So they're Floridians, though?
No. Nobody's... They moved to Florida when I was a child. But they stayed. They kept property there. And then when they retired, my parents, my brother, and my grandmother all moved back.
And where in Florida?
The town where I grew up doesn't really exist anymore because I grew up in what was then a little town called Winter Park.
I know exactly Winter Park. Well, I went to Rollins.
Oh, I didn't know you went to Rollins. That was across the lake from my house.
Oh, Rollins.
I used to swim at Dinky Dock.
Well, do you know who lives in Winter Park now? Billy Collins.
I did not know that.
He moved there. Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
Yes, and Rollins used to be a funky little place when I was in graduate school.
I know.
There.
This was pre-Disney. That's why I say it doesn't exist
it
anymore.
It is pre-Disney.
Yeah. The last hurricane I was down for was Hurricane Charlie. And, of course, power got knocked out. And so I had to spend the night in the dark with the windows open. And the frogs were so loud, you couldn't hear yourself think. And so when I went to write this poem, I said, I'm going to write about Florida, but I had no idea what. And all of a sudden, all I could think about were the frogs. So this is called East Florida. Beneath the hazed moon, this hazy absence of stars, how the hearts of the frogs are breaking, how they stretch and bloat the fine elastic of their chests, and how their bloated hearts are so greatly breaking. This night of camp tent swelter belongs to the frogs. The distant car rattling slowly home, and the nameless distant dog know nothing of barrenness. The lone washer chuffing through the open door of the laundromat cannot muster an equal grief. So let us pause then to give praise for the broad nostrils and the glottises of frogs. Let us pause for the great and cupidinous faith that doles and gravels in the swell of their thousand throats, in the gelant swell of a thousand bulged and gibbous jowls. Beneath the street lamps, the damp porches din with a stridulous passion. The car lots and darkened surf stands echo with an unbroken desolation and hope. So let the vacant causeway crowd with wheeze and jug and hoop, the slim alleys hoarsen and gruff. Let us now give loud and stentorian praise for the gullets of frogs, that their maws may widen, their dry lips bubble and their bellies spread, that they may throb and chirrup and croak unendingly, unendingly, of strange and taintless beauty, make of our portion proper melody.
You take things that are hard to love and you love them.
They're so much easier to write about, things like frogs and cockroaches and eels
and
than
worms.
It is to write. And worms. Well, they're more interesting. The language that you, I mean, that poem was so
the
much
gullets.
Fun.
Oh, think of all the things that you could say about the frog, and you did.
The coming up with all the sounds they make, the whoops and chirrups and throbs and jugs, that was so much fun. And you can't say that about a lark.
Have you ever written a haiku?
Not a good one.
Because they love those sounds. You know, they yes. love to imitate the sounds of creatures. And
right.
I just would love to know if you would write a haiku someday.
As I said, not a good
but
one.
But have you ever tried one?
I'm sure I have. I probably started trying when I was 12 years old.
Yeah, but we're not 5'7" now. You know, that is just something the English teachers
right.
made up, right? Because the Japanese are 18 syllables vertical.
Right.
So I would really love to see you home in on one image and just make it burst. We'll see. That's a challenge. But before you go into this poem, what were you like as a little girl?
I loved to read. I was unique in my family in that. Nobody else in my family, I don't think, has ever voluntarily picked up a book. My brother was a scientist. My father's a finance guy. And my mother designed beautiful houses. But nobody else liked to read.
Where do you think you came from?
I don't know. If I didn't look like a perfect amalgam of my parents, I'd be sure that, you know, there was a mistake at the hospital. But I was also a tomboy. I used to climb orange trees and swim and go to the library. And
were you good at sports?
Not really. I was a tomboy, but no, I was never good at sports.
Mm-hmm. What were the first books you remember as a child? I mean, I can remember being smitten by books as a child.
My favorite book for my mother to read to me, you know, at bedtime was Alice in Wonderland.
Oh,
the
yeah.
chapter of Wool and Water was my favorite chapter. And I loved Winnie the
Pooh. I can see how you were influenced by that.
Oh, that's just a marvelous book. And the illustrations are so marvelous. And
that's a lot to read to a
yes.
child.
And
so when you read yourself, when you were getting your own books, what were the things you remember
When I got to adolescence, I just, you know, like many adolescents, I just read everything I could get my hands on.
But did you begin with things like A Tree Grows in Brooklyn?
I did read that. I read, you know, I got permission at the library. Back then, there was the children's section and the adult section, and the children were not allowed in the adult section. Well, the only thing my mother would ever read would be once in a while she'd like a murder mystery, like an Agatha Christie. And so I said, you know, Mom, let me get them for you. And so she talked to the librarian, and I got permission to go into the adult section. And so I checked out a lot of books that my mother had no idea I was reading. And I really didn't understand them because they were adult people doing adult
things. But how did you choose the books? Just pull them off the shelf?
Yeah, I've read, you know, I was at that age when you just inhale everything you can.
Well, not everyone does.
I mean, I read Ayn Rand. I read.
Oh my gosh.
I read Mein Kampf. I read Robert Frost. I read, you know, everything there was out there. I read Pulp Fiction. I read everything.
Well, you see, I predate you so much that when I was a little girl in the library, the only thing that was like Rudyard Kipling, some British poets. That's all, white men.
I had Robert Louis Stevenson's Childhood's Garden of Verse.
But that you should, everyone should have that.
Yes.
That's quite beautiful.
I think I like it better now than I did as a child.
It wasn't enough for you.
Well, it just was too pretty.
Yeah.
It now I look at it and I appreciate it a lot more. But at the time,
well,
it wasn't
my favorite book. Well, the
romantics,
you have to grow into the romantics,
yes.
You know. I know. And so you were a librarian.
Yes, but I was a librarian at the Department of Energy.
What does that mean?
I was a reference librarian. And it meant that people would come to me and say, oh, they'd be shipping nuclear waste along a certain route. And they say, we need to know what every newspaper along this route is saying about it.
So you're scientific?
No.
Oh, you just knew how to find things.
Yes. I'm very logical, which is kind of surprising. But it takes a very specific type of logic to do those sort of searches.
Or a palindrome.
Yeah, or a palindrome, yes.
And so I thought you were like, at some Maryland library.
Oh, my dream going into it would be at Enoch Pratt or someplace wonderful, but jobs were hard to get, and I was very happy to get any kind of job at all.
And you retired as one.
Yes.
You had a lifelong career as a librarian.
Not lifelong. It was.
Oh.
I never held jobs for very long. I really would come to hate every job I ever had. All I wanted to do was be a poet. That was all I ever wanted to do, and I didn't want to be a poetry teacher because I figured I would come to hate poetry if I did that. And my last job at the Department of Energy was 3 years, 9 months, and 6 days. And that was the longest.
But you retired.
I retired because I inherited some money.
Oh, well, we won't go into all your private stuff here. We won't go into the private stuff.
I retired at 45, and that's when I started writing again. I had stopped writing for almost 20 years. I had a 20 years writer block.
I am really shocked.
And
I wondered why I just found your book at 2013.
Yes, and then when I retired.
10 years ago.
And I. My father was controlling the money, and so it was in a trust. And I said, if you'll just give me enough to pay off my mortgage, I can live off of the interest for 2 years, and let me write for 2 years before I go back to work.
Oh, that's so heartwarming.
And then I started writing, and then, you know,
And then you won so many awards. You won so many awards. That must have been very gratifying for you.
It was interesting.
You can still get a Guggenheim.
It's too much paperwork.
Yeah,
I've looked at
paperwork.
It. I'm so bad.
Okay,
at
the last thing I want to ask you is, did you ever think that you would see librarians harassed, fired, trolled, and despised for getting children to read books? Did you ever think that books were banned in America?
One of the independent studies I did in library and school was on censorship in libraries. And there was a lot going on at the time with the Washington Blade, which was given out free in libraries. And people were coming in and taking all the copies, and people were saying that the librarians were, you know, sexually grooming children. And it was, you know, it was absolutely ridiculous. And I did a paper on that. And that was the precursor to the horrors that have come since.
But what year was that?
That would have been about 90, I think.
That, I cannot believe that.
I think so, 90, 92. I think that's about when I was in library in school.
Oh.
But
I didn't know the Blade was really under fire.
Oh, yes. It was under, and people were stealing. They would drop off a bundle of the newspapers outside the library.
We should say that's a gay newspaper. People might not know.
Okay. And And there would be people waiting in cars, and they would steal the copy so the library couldn't get them. And the librarians, you know, went to the police, and they said, well, there's nothing we can do because they're free. So they're not stealing since they're free. And so the librarians had to keep them behind the desk, which meant people had to ask for them, which meant people who were closeted.
Yeah, but you never thought of what would happen today.
Oh.
We will have a final poem.
Okay. This poem was inspired by a gift that a friend gave me. Every year she used to give me a calendar, you know, one of those tearaway daily calendars of archaic words, which of course I just loved. And one of the words was cupshotten, which means drunk. And I thought, well, that's a very fun word. And I said, I bet there are a lot of other fun words and idioms for being drunk. And so I spent a lot of time going through thesauri and going through old things. And I came up with this lovely list of words, and it turned into a poem. Cupshotten, or in other words, to be flown high up the pole, alpine as a kite, rendered sacksopped or muzzy, lushed, boxed, and or bumpsy, gone potsmit and sodded, face-foxed or malty, left whistled, jug-bitten, tipped tilt as a wheelbarrow, or wrapped in warm flannel. However, the mother tongue maunders her long, labyrinth, liquid way round. Here we are, tripping up in our cups, not legless or toe-row, oh my lovely, not staggered or tight, but still reeling ripe, feeling pipped. And isn't it all replete as a peach, our swizzle stick flirt and this breezy, voluptuous rush, be it glass, be it barrel, that disburdens the weight of decorum to devil dry virtue and gust up your skirt.
The voice of Haley Lighthizer, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Maryland State Arts Council, the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family, Natalie Canavore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.